It's time once again for another episode of Planning Successfully, brought to you by the law firm of Davis, Matthews, and Quigley. Planning Successfully is for general information purposes only, and no information discussed during the show is to be considered either legal advice or legal opinion. Broadcasting live from the Pro Business Channel studios in Atlanta. And now here's your host for today's episode, Matthew Theory.
Welcome, and thank you again for joining us for this episode of Planning Successfully. I'm your host, Matt Theory. I'm joined again today in studio by my colleague, Rhett Peden. At this point, Rhett's pretty much a regular as opposed to a guest, but I'd like to welcome him back, and I'm happy to have him in studio again. Rhett and I are both shareholders at Davis, Matthews, and Quigley. My practice focuses on business law, business litigation, fiduciary litigation, as well as providing mediator and arbitrator services. I fill the role of outside general counsel to businesses that have a need for legal services, but not enough of a need to employ a lawyer full time. I'd like to give a moment to Rhett to let him reintroduce himself and his practice as well.
Well, thank you, Matt. Again, I'm a shareholder at DMQ. I work in the area of M&A, taxation, general corporate law, and estates and trust. Work with a lot of closely held businesses and professional services firms looking to either get them down to the next generation or if they're interested in selling their business, I work to help them through that process.
Thanks, Rhett. You can learn more about Rhett, you can learn more about me or the other attorneys at Davis, Matthews, and Quigley by visiting our website, which is www.dmqlaw.com. We've come to the end of this run of the series of Planning Successfully, and as such, before I jump into today's topic, I would like to provide a few thank yous. And first, I'd like to thank the Pro Business Channel, particularly folks like Rich, Craig, Stephen, and Elizabeth that have helped us out in so many ways. Yeah, exactly. Thanks. Pro Business has been an outstanding partner to work with throughout this show, and I've gained some new friends along the way. So I'm very, very pleased with the run of this show and the experience that we've had. And I would encourage anyone listening that's considering getting on the air or wanting to get their message out to the public to get in touch with Rich. I think getting in touch with Rich and get it on the air, make it happen. So with the thank yous out of the way, I'd like to move on to today's topic, and tis the season. Today we're going to talk about taxation.
It's always the season for me.
We're going to discuss some of the tax considerations that businesses need to make from the beginning when they form their business, throughout business, and we're also going to take a little bit of time today to talk about some of the potential changes in tax law that are being discussed at this time. So with that, we're going to start into the startup phase when you're starting a new business, and you get into the issues of what type of entity, and we discussed entity selection in I think our inaugural episode, and fitting that we're tying up again with that topic again here at the end. But I would like to say that when we talked about it in the inaugural episode, we were talking about more considerations than taxation. Today we're going to focus on the tax side of things. And Rhett, you know, we get into the issue all the time of, should this be a corporation? If so, what type of corporation? Should it be a partnership, an LLC? And, you know, a lot of times I think with the closely held or the smaller businesses, folks start asking questions like, if I pick an LLC versus an S-Corp, you know, how does that affect me with the self-employment taxation issue? Should I just take an S-Corp to avoid the self-employment taxation? So if you'd kind of walk through some of the issues, the effect on taxation of the owners and with respect to these different entities.
Well, thanks, Matt. It's always a consideration. You have to think about taxes. And I tell people, don't always let the tax tail to wag the dog, but it's there. Everybody faces it, and we've got to consider it when we're starting up a business. And aside from the liability issues that we had in creditor protection that we had talked about starting up a business in our inaugural episode, tax played a part of that. And the biggest difference you're going to look at from a tax standpoint is, are you going to be a pass-through entity, or are you going to pay tax at the entity level? So the typical corporation that historically was set up is called a C-Corp. That has to do with the part of the Internal Revenue Code that these provisions are found in. A C-Corp means that you're going to pay tax at the corporate level. And, of course, you're going to have, as an owner or as an employee of the company, you're going to have employment income, which is going to be taxed to you individually. But that amount that's going down to you as an employee is a deduction for the company. But whatever's left over in the company at the end of the year, that's going to be taxed at the corporate level of taxation. And then in the future, if there are dividends paid out to you as an owner, you're going to pay tax again on those dividends when that tax comes out. Therefore, it's called that there's a dual taxation with a C corporation. Now, the other types of entities that are out there are pass-through entities. That means there's not going to be a separate level of tax imposed at the corporation. Instead, the owner is going to report on their own return the income of that business. And the income that's thrown off by the business is essentially that owner's personal income. But there are some differences whether you have a partnership or an LLC versus an S-corp. And the big difference is with an S-corporation, you pay out compensation. And then if you don't pay out something as compensation and you just earn it as profit, you're not paying the self-employment tax on the amount that is retained by the company. You're taxed on that as income, but you don't have to pay the employment tax on that portion of the income of the S-corporation. If you've just got a pure flow-through like a partnership or an LLC, you're going to be paying possibly tax on the whole amount, especially if it's something that you're actively involved in, you're actively running. All the income that's thrown off is going to be subject to the employment tax. And once you're past the Social Security base, which you get past that, you don't have to pay any additional Social Security tax. You've still got the Medicare portion of the tax that you have to pick up, really that's not capped. So an unlimited amount you would be facing as that tax on an LLC or through a partnership, but you could potentially avoid that 2% plus Medicare tax on the S-corporation earnings. So there are some other differences between the entities. With an LLC, you have a lot more flexibility in how you structure it than you do with an S-corporation. But fundamentally, that's the big tax difference, that Medicare portion that you can potentially save by setting up as an S-corporation. You could also, for example, set up as an LLC and later make an S-corporation election for your LLC. So even if you set up as an LLC to start with, you haven't foreclosed the possibility, if it makes sense, to make an S-corporation election.
And that goes back to your flexibility.
That's right. You've got a lot more flexibility when you're doing business in an LLC, which is kind of our default that we put entities into today. I mean, there are other reasons that we might want to use a different structure, but we generally start with saying, well, why wouldn't an LLC work in this situation?
Sure. And so we're talking about the tax implications to the owners. Let's talk just for a second about phantom income. With respect to these pass-through entities, you know, when people think of income, most people think of income in the context of, you know, money that came out of the company and went into my pocket. On these pass-through entities, you could have phantom income where the company has income on its books and you didn't necessarily end up taking that money and putting it into your pocket. So talk a little bit about that concept.
Well, that's right. If you have a partner or you have another shareholder, you can run into this issue. Obviously, if you're the sole owner of the company, you can take out whatever you want generally. But if you've got a partnership and you've decided that, you know, you've got somebody that decides they want to retain some of the earnings into the company, for example, to you know, to fund some acquisitions, or you need to build up some inventory, or they just decide we need a cash cushion in this company, then if that money's not being distributed out to you, then you're paying taxes on the income that's being held in the company, even though you're not seeing those dollars.
Right.
So when we generally, when we have people, multiple people starting a company, whether it's going to be an S-corp or a partnership, we will put a provision into the operating agreement or the shareholders agreement that guarantees distributions to the shareholders or the members to cover their tax liability, because you don't generally want to be in a situation where you owe taxes on the money, but you can't get the money out to pay your taxes. And we've seen disputes where this has become an issue when there are co-owner disputes, and it's just better to address that up front and have a provision where you're guaranteed that you will at least get the money out of the company to pay your taxes.
Okay. And moving from the issue of taxation to the owners, right, let's talk just for a second about the entity selection issues and the tax relation to ultimate disposition of the business. How do those interplay as well?
Well, whatever you've set yourself up in the beginning, that's going to affect how you're able to dispose of the business later on. If you've got a C corporation, you're probably not going to want to do an asset sale because you're going to have to pay taxes at the level of the corporation before you can get the money out of the company. So you're going to be looking more towards a stock sale in that situation. If you're set up as an S corporation, you could probably go either way. There's a special election that sometimes you can make called a 338H10 election so that you sell the stock in the S corporation, but for tax purposes is treated as an asset sale. And there's an ability there sometimes so that both parties come out better by making a 338H10 election because the buyer of your S corporation gets a step up in basis on the assets, a tax basis step up in the assets that they buy, even though they've really bought legally, they've bought stock. So there's some interplay there that you can do with an S corporation. You've got some flexibility. If you've got a LLC, you can either do it as a membership interest purchase agreement, which is where you buy the membership interest, or you can do it as a asset sale out of the assets. So you've got some flexibility there. But how you set the company up originally and the tax basis you have in the both the shares and your membership interest and the tax basis in the assets of the company are going to affect your tax bill at the ultimate disposition. So it's important to think about that when you set up the company, but also to get some lead time before you do a transaction to figure out what your tax alternatives are, because you don't want to wind up in a situation where you have a big tax bill that you weren't expecting just because you didn't think through the steps of how that deal looked and how it's structured.
Sure. And in addition, this could obviously affect the company's ability to raise capital, the entity selection and the taxation that comes along with that.
That's right. And it's going to affect the price that someone's willing to pay for the company. If they're buying your stock, but they're not getting an ability to get an increase in the basis for the assets so that they can then the new owner can depreciate those assets and get a tax benefit, or if there's some embedded tax liabilities in a company that they're picking up, that they're buying, they're going to want a discount for those embedded tax liabilities. So it really plays a role in how much you can sell the company for. And historically, not so much now, but C corporations were much more likely to be able to raise capital than an LLC. An LLC is we say it's relatively recent. Now it's going on, 25 years that we've had these. But people that used to be in the capital raising business weren't as familiar with LLCs and how that would look. So now it's a little bit different. You're a little bit more able to raise capital as an LLC. But C corporations are going to be easier, especially if you're looking pretty soon at doing some raising of capital. Those are probably going to be more what people are looking at, and they're more used to seeing those if you're trying to go through a round and raise capital. So it does affect it. So if you were to come in and say, I'm setting up this company and I want to get go through a fundraising round in 6 months or a year, that might be one of the reasons we sit back and say, well, does an LLC make sense? We can certainly structure it as an LLC, but what are these other folks looking for that are going to be giving you capital, and how should we structure that for them to make it easier to raise capital?
Okay. And Rhett, so when we're talking about raising capital, and sometimes we're talking about here the disposition of the company, how does the structure impact like a sale or a recapitalization of an existing business?
Well, it's just part of the issue that if you're going to be a buyer, you're going to have to look at the tax attributes of the business that you're picking up. And if you're restructuring your business, even if you're not really bringing in a third party, but you have different companies, different entities that you want to merge or you want to separate them out, it's very important to consult with a tax advisor before you do that, because there are provisions that are specially set out in the Internal Revenue Code that allows you to do a tax-free merger or a tax-free recapitalization. And you don't want to get into a situation where you're kind of transferring assets or entities around, even if you're really just the owner of everything, but you're inadvertently triggering tax when you make these transfers. So it's very important to make sure that all of these transfers that you're doing, even if you're the only party that's involved in doing these transfers, that you're not inadvertently triggering a tax when you swap stock or put assets from one company to another. You want to make sure that you're doing it in a way that it comes within the safe harbors that the code provides.
And on a previous show, we talked a little bit about how divorce interplays with business and how businesses can plan to handle divorce issues ahead of time, and how oftentimes business owners don't want to contemplate the possibility of one of the partners going through a divorce situation in their lifetime. So how does this structure deal with a marital dissolution as well?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of family divorce lawyers out there don't necessarily think about the tax issues before they enter into their agreements, but they really should, because the last thing you want to do is get divorced. And I've seen this happen in other situations that I've had clients come to me from that have had divorces, and suddenly they're stuck with a large tax bill that they weren't anticipating because they didn't address the issues of liability up front, who is going to be responsible for the taxes. They didn't look into see whether the dispositions of the property were going to be taxable or not. Generally, when you're going through a marital dissolution, you're getting a divorce, you should really structure it so that it's going to be a tax-free situation. There are provisions in the code that allow you to divide property between spouses. But again, there are safe harbors, and if you fit within those safe harbors and the rules, then you're really safe. But if you ignore those rules, you're doing it at your peril, and you don't want to trigger a taxable situation. So generally, if you have what's called equitable division of property, and it occurs, is provided for under the divorce settlement agreement, it happens within a relatively short period of time after the divorce, or if it's longer, there's a legitimate business reason why you're not able to divide that property immediately after the divorce. Maybe there's some sort of shareholders agreement that keeps you from selling that property or dividing it so that you have to wait until later on to divide the property, then you're okay. But if you're not following those rules and those safe harbors set out in the code, you could have a situation where you're dividing property and suddenly it becomes a taxable event when you divide the property. And you also, there are rules with respect to alimony, whether it's going to be deductible or not deductible when you're paying it. The difference between alimony and division of property is alimony is where you're providing support to your former spouse, and that support's either going to be deductible to you and taxable to your spouse, or it's not. But there are very specific rules that you've got to make sure you follow so that you can, if you're the payor, you can get the benefit of the deduction. There are other issues. If it's not properly structured, you could have adverse gift and estate tax consequences. There, again, there are safe harbors that you can fall within that it's not considered a gift when you transfer property between spouses pursuant to a divorce. But if you're not paying attention to those rules, you could fall outside of them and suddenly trigger a gift tax consequence. And another thing that commonly comes up with taxation are quadros, which is a way that specifically the government has provided that you have to jump through certain steps in order to divide certain qualified benefits. That wouldn't be an IRA, but if you have a 401k, which a lot of people do, or a pension plan, there are specific rules about how you have to go through and divide those between spouses. And if you don't, you could, again, have some very adverse and unexpected both tax and division of property consequences.
And you mentioned the word quadro, right? And that's short. That's lawyer slang for qualified domestic relations order. And that's an order that a judge would enter in a divorce case that would go to the plan administrator and dictate how the assets within that plan are dealt with.
That's right. So it's something that really generally takes place shortly after the divorce is finalized. And then as part of implementing the divorce, if there are assets that require this qualified domestic relations order, the quadro, then you have to separately enter those and go through several steps with the plan administrator. That's the person who's in the company or the that's administering the pension or that has custody of the 401k, so that they sign off on the order and will divide the assets appropriately with the appropriate tax consequences to the former husband and wife.
Right, right. So let's talk for a second about employee compensation. Obviously, there are a lot of tax issues in dealing with employee comp. One being, when is the comp taxable to the deductible to the company? I'm sorry, and that's a big issue.
I mean, generally, people think, right, you write a check and somebody gets paid, it's income to them, and it's a deduction to the company. And that's, with most paychecks, that's the case. But Once you have, if you've got a startup company and you're rewarding some of your employees and managers with stock or membership interest, it suddenly becomes a lot grayer and murkier, and it's not as clear cut as when things are deductible. And so there are Section 83B elections that are very important to make sure that they're filed appropriately and timely. What that does is that makes something immediately, generally it makes it immediately deductible to the company and income to the employee. But in the future, that makes all the gain from that property that you're giving the employee subject to long-term capital gains rates and not something that is taxable ordinary income to them at much higher rates. If you don't make that 83B election appropriately and timely, if the company sells, let's say, 10 years later, and that stock or that interest you've given the employee has exploded in value, 100% of that value is going to be subject to tax at ordinary rates, which now is close to 40% plus, instead of a much better capital gains rate. So it's important to make sure that you filed those 83B elections. It's important to see if you've got something called deferred compensation, if it's qualified or non-qualified. Qualified, it fits into certain rules that the service has set out that governs the deductibility and when it's included in income. But non-qualified deferred compensation, for example, let's say you're an athlete and you're going to get paid over a period of years, and it's not just based on the year that you've worked, but you've got bonuses that if you play in the Super Bowl, it's going to be paid next year, or you hit certain targets, or if you're a doctor, let's say, and you've left your job, but you've got patients that are still paying income, kind of these tail payments that come in later after you've left, and they're paid in the next year, that's deferred compensation. Or if you tell someone, look, if you come work for me for the next 5 years, I'll allow you to defer some of your compensation so that in year 6, 7, 8, maybe when you've retired, your tax rate is lower and the company maybe is better able to pay some salary, we'll pay you in those years, even though you're no longer with us. That's deferred compensation. And one of the things that's happened in the last few years is there's a section of the code called 409A. And that places a lot of rules and restrictions on how you can get paid your deferred compensation. And if you don't follow those rules, it's a 20% additional penalty that the taxpayer has to pay on their deferred compensation. And that arose after Enron, where a lot of the high-paid executives were able, they knew the company was going down, they went ahead and cashed in their deferred comp and got all this money before the company went down the chutes. And Congress stepped in and said, we don't want that to happen anymore. So you're not going to be able to just go in and cash in your compensation, even though you know the company's going down. But the law that they passed was so broad,
right,
that it doesn't just apply to public companies or companies like Enron. It applies to any company, even a startup or a small company that has deferred compensation. And that's a lot of our tech clients are rewarding employees on that basis.
And I think a lot of what you're talking about here, you don't have to be Enron. You don't have to be the owners of a company that are doing perceivably bad things. You could be a very well-meaning business owner trying to set forth a comp plan that you think is fair to you and fair to your employee, and without knowing what you're doing, step into tax problems for either you or for that employee.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so let's talk just for a second about international investments for individuals and businesses. Whether they're subject to or not subject to U.S. taxes and what that looks like, because I think a lot of tax issues come up when you're dealing with international business.
And increasingly so. And you've got so many families, too, that now are international fortunately, they generally know that they should probably pay attention to these issues. But if you've got a business or an investor coming in, they just need to be aware of U.S. taxes. The U.S. estate tax system particularly can catch up a lot of foreign investors that they're not even aware of it. That happens because the U.S. Taxes its citizens, unlike almost any other country in the world, based on citizenship. So you could be a U.S. citizen doing business overseas. Those overseas assets are going to be pulled into your U.S. taxable estate. Plus, anyone who comes into the U.S. and has U.S. assets are going to be subject to the U.S. estate tax system. So they're kind of Uncle Sam's getting you going and coming, whereas most other countries in the world are only going to be taxed on the basis of residency. And if you're actually on location in that country living there, then they'll actually look at your assets that are there to tax them. So the U.S. tax system really captures a lot of assets that other systems don't. So you just need to be aware and look at that. And the other issue that's come up very frequently in the last couple of years with our clients is the FBAR and FATCA reporting with foreign assets and foreign bank accounts. And this is this reporting obligation, the penalties are very steep if you don't comply, and it's made it very hard for American expatriates or people that do business abroad to open up foreign bank accounts because many international financial institutions have just decided they don't want to deal with this headache of having American clients and the liabilities that come up there with reporting. So it's a live issue, and it's increasingly affecting our clients.
I wanted to talk. We have a few minutes left, and I know we're not going to get through all of the tax changes that are being proposed right now. But as everyone knows, we have a new administration, and regardless of your political views or affiliations, there are some proposed changes to the tax codes and regulations that could affect every U.S. citizen going forward. And let's talk. You mentioned a moment ago some estate taxes. Let's talk a little bit about what is the estate tax and what's being discussed.
Well, right now we've got a pretty, based on historical perspective, a pretty good system for the taxpayer. We've got exemption levels that are up to $5.49 million for an individual, and a married couple then could shelter almost $11 million of assets, and that's going up with inflation being adjusted every year. But after that, it's 40% on the dollar of any assets in excess of $11 million, and it's due 9 months after you die. The estate tax is due if you owe one. And there's a lot of regulations that govern how that is going to be taxed that have developed over the last 50, 60, 70 years and about how people try to avoid it. What the administration has decided and is going to be probably part of their proposal is to eliminate the estate tax. But that creates a lot of questions that they haven't really answered, which is one of the biggest questions is what happens to your step-up in basis. The benefit of paying or being subject to the estate tax is that when someone dies, all of their assets get a step-up in basis to their date of death value. So it eliminates, for example, all the gains in all of their property that they have.
So the heir takes it at the current value as opposed to the value that it was purchased at.
That's right. So if you bought a house, 30 years ago for $100,000 and it's worth $500,000 when you die, your heirs are going to get a house with a $500,000 basis. When they sell it, there's no tax.
Right.
And that applies whether it's Coke stock, a business, anything.
So the $400,000 of gains that were built into that scenario are now gone because of the step-up in basis.
That's right. Everybody wants it, but no one wants to die to get it. But that's the only way that you can get it is to die. So that's the step-up in basis. And it's not clear that if the estate tax goes away, how that step-up in basis is going to work, if it's still going to be available. It's very popular that a lot of people appreciate it and like it. They've talked about having just a blanket step up in basis up to a certain amount so that middle class taxpayers will still get the benefit of the step up in basis. But it's not clear how that's applied. And I mean, if you have two different kids, how do they split the step up in basis?
Right.
Do you put it to the house? Do you put it to the stock? Who gets what? How do you keep records from that? Last couple times that they've experimented with that, back in the 70s and then back in 2012 for 1 year, it didn't work very well, and so that creates a lot of issues, and I'm not sure that they've looked into those. They're also the estate tax as it is now, especially for very wealthy taxpayers, is one of the at least nonprofits believe it's one of the reasons that they are able to get so many bequests. People get an unlimited charitable deduction on any charitable gifts. And if there's no longer an estate tax, a lot of nonprofits and charities are thinking that they may lose some of those dollars that are coming to them from people that are dying. So that's another issue.
And like I led in with this, we're talking about discussions and proposals and changes that are being kicked around as ideas at this point in time. Obviously, they haven't been completely fleshed out at this point, and obviously, things could stay exactly as they are with no change. That this is just something that's it's a discussion at this early stage discussion.
They've just talked about it. you know, but like the accountants and lawyers have this joke that every time they change the tax laws, the unofficial title of the act is the Lawyer and Accountant Employment Act. So whatever it is, it's probably going to be hard to figure out, and it'll take some time to adjust to it. But there have also been changes. There've been talk about making changes on the income tax system, simplifying it. They've talked about how they're looking to take over 50% of the households off the income tax rolls. I'm not sure what that means. I mean, a lot of people file taxes today, for example, to get the earned income tax credit. How are you going to check that and make sure that people are legitimately claiming the benefit of not filing? I just don't see how they're going to get the IRS out of the picture and accomplish this and without, you know, this vast overhaul, without some checks and balances in the system. It's going to be hard.
Right. So we're just about out of time, so I would like to just say, you know, as we're talking about, laws are continuously changing, and obviously the taxation laws and other laws continuously change in how they impact business as well.
And, right. We could have probably a whole nother show just on the tax reform proposals.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And Rhett and I are happy to talk to you and help you understand the current laws, the changes that may come, the changes that do come, as well as exploring the best ways to protect and grow your business. You know, the concept of planning successfully is a proactive approach, and as in most things in life, you see better results from being proactive than you do from reactive. We look forward to hearing from you. We look forward to helping you achieve your goals. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Planning Successfully. You can learn more about DMQ and its attorneys at www.dmqlaw.com. You can follow DMQ on Twitter at DMQLaw. You can follow me on Twitter at Matthew Theory. You can reach us by telephone at 404-261-3900. Thanks again for listening to Planning Successfully.
Thank you again for joining us and our guests on Planning Successfully. Use the social media links here to share today's show and stay tuned for the next episode of Planning Successfully, brought to you by the law firm of Davis, Matthews & Quigley. Planning Successfully is for general informational purposes only, and no information discussed during this show is to be considered either legal advice or legal opinion. To connect with the show's sponsor, visit dmqlaw.com. And to listen to previous broadcasts, visit planningsuccessfully.com.